Hello and welcome to Focus on Business. I am your host, Lee Strickland. Here's a reminder that comments, views, and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of WCOM, its board, and underwriters. And now, today's program. My guest for today is Mike McCready of Music X-Ray. Mike is a successful musician with two hit singles and a successful entrepreneur. His companies have been featured in Success Magazine, The New Yorker, and other media. And one of those businesses actually became a Harvard Business School case and has been profiled in several documentaries and on a couple of network television series. Mike has combined his passion for music and business into a highly successful career and has been putting those skills to work for Music X-Ray, an online platform that connects music industry talent with commercial opportunities. Music X-Ray is focused on providing decision makers with the best tools for deciding which songs and artists to use for their projects. This platform makes available tools to streamline, organize, and optimize their work and their decisions while reducing the risk of making choices that don't meet business objectives. Mike, thanks for joining me on the program today.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, I understand from some of the stuff I've been doing and the research in the company, you've been guiding Music X-Ray through the startup stage, getting funding and all of that. And so talk a little bit about that experience and what it's been like to do that.
Oh, that has been excruciating. You know, I think raising funding is one of the hardest things that you do, especially the first time as an entrepreneur. This is my third time, so it has gotten easier over the years. It's certainly easier if you have previously made some of your investors some money. But you're still dealing with the fact that your business plan and your vision has to make real sense. You have to show the investors the pathway from where you are to a return on their investment. And that's not always easy, especially if you're a creative entrepreneur and what you have is a fantastic idea, but you're not a spreadsheet person, you're not a numbers person, and you may not have experience in building a whole model that includes cost of sales, cost of the sales cycle, how you're going to finance the company while all of those things occur, while you've hired some people but don't yet have sales, don't yet have revenue. I've found that, there are angel investors that an angel investor being different from a venture capital firm. An angel investor is typically a high net worth individual who likes to invest in small businesses and help them get going and can provide their expertise or their experience. Sometimes they're former entrepreneurs themselves who get you and understand that maybe you're a first time entrepreneur and you need some hand holding. A venture capital firm really expects you to come in the door knowing your stuff with a team that's experienced and has been around the block before. I've worked with both over the course of my career, but it is one of the hardest things you do as an entrepreneur to raise funds.
So how can you contrast like that first time that you went out and you were, like you said, you're the creative entrepreneur versus, getting your training wheels now by the third go around. What were the biggest lessons from the first time that you were able to apply this third time when you've gone through funding?
Oh, wow. Well, I think by the third time around, you really have learned the language of the investor and what they're looking for. You can really anticipate the questions that they're going to ask. The first time around, I really did need a lot of handholding. I needed to understand that, if I was building a spreadsheet to show what I thought my sales were going to be over the following year, or that they'll usually ask you to build the model out for 3 years. So these are all things you learned the first time around as well.
Right.
And they want you to back up your metrics to the smallest degree. They want to know, for example, how large the market is that you're trying to address. In our case, it would be, you could consider it to be upstart musicians. How many upstart musicians are out there that are trying to make it into the music industry? Then they want to know, how are you going to contact them? How are you going to reach them and make them aware of your business and your proposition? Then they want to know what percentage of that available market do you think you can capture and over what period of time? And how much do you think it's going to cost you, whether that's in online advertising or some other type of marketing initiative, to capture each customer? And then they'll say, okay, once you've captured the customer, how much of whatever you're selling them do you have to sell them in order to cover your costs of reaching the audience and capturing the customer and then sell the product? If you're making a product, then you have to include the cost of making that product and then have your profit margin and make sure that your profit margin is enough to pay for the people that you hired. And if not, and that's where the investor comes in, how much money do they have to give you up front to cover all of these costs before you're starting to make the money and make a return on the investment? And I think the first time around, I was not prepared for the level of minutia that I would have to build into a model for an investor to say, okay, I see how this is going from here to there. I'll write you a check.
Well, and I think that's part I try to tell my clients when we're going through this phase is that if you're building credibility, the more facts you have to back up, you can assume a lot of things, but you can't assume everything. And the more facts we can get in that phase and build those models up, it gives you that expertise, that guru of your business, your market, your people. And so that does make the investor much more comfortable when they're trying to make that investment decision, especially in a first-time entrepreneur.
It's a double-edged sword, because when you don't have the business up and running yet, or it's still in the idea phase and you're building a model out, and you don't know exactly how much it's going to cost you to acquire a new customer, so you make an assumption. And you don't know exactly some of the other variables in there, maybe exactly how much it's going to cost you to make the product, so you make an assumption. And you can make assumptions and back up your assumptions with some research or some data that maybe you've gotten from your suppliers. But as long as it's an assumption and you've backed it up and the future looks really bright, you might be able to raise money on a higher valuation of your company than you could if you're actually a year into the future and you actually have the real numbers by then. You know what it costs you to acquire a customer. You know what it costs you to make the product. And maybe those numbers don't look as rosy as your assumptions were. And if you're trying to raise money at that stage, you might actually get a lower valuation, even though the business is already up and running.
Well, and that's one of the challenges, I think, that everyone is like, well, it's a plan. I made assumptions. It's going to change. And the investor knows that. You know, you're doing your best at different points in time with the amount of information you have. But tell me a little bit about how you went about getting the minutia to build your financial model, your projections, and get Music X-Ray up and going.
You know, that was something I was never really good at. In fact, I'd say I'm much better at it than I ever was in the past. But I still rely on a finance person, even our investment bankers at the stage of the game that we are today at Music X-Ray, to help me model those things out. There are just core competencies. Any entrepreneur has the things that they do best, and the value that they bring to the table. In my case, it's the ability to envision and build a great product, and I'm a really good executor of a plan. But I'm not a good finance person. I'm not the guy, and the detail, minutiae of spreadsheets just make my eyes glaze over.
Well, that's why you need people like me.
Exactly. And, an entrepreneur should focus their efforts on what they really do best and what they love to do, and bring in other people around them who love to do those other things and do them really well. And sure, you know, you need to understand it. You can't just put it in someone's hands and say you do it. You do have to put in the effort of sitting down with that person and having it explained to you, so that when you go into the meeting with the investors, you at least look like you know how to talk the talk.
Well, and when we get into those investor meetings, and I like to route my clients now that Shark Tank is on, you know, it's kind of a good teaching tool, because people give a business valuation, and then when the investor says, well, how did you arrive at that valuation, and they just get a blank expression on their face because they haven't worked in those numbers enough to absorb them and understand how to articulate them. How can you emphasize that enough to potential entrepreneurs out there that are listening, that they really have to do that work, and that's the make and break point of getting investor confidence?
Yeah, when you don't have any numbers yet, valuation is as much an art as a science. It's tricky. One kind of rule of thumb that you can use is, usually that first investor who comes on board, or that the first round of investment, whether, you know, sometimes it's friends and family and sometimes it's several people, but that first chunk of money that you need to get the business from A to B is usually going to, you know, an investor is usually going to want 20 to 30% of your business in exchange for that money. So you kind of have to look at what you're projecting your revenue and your profits to be a couple years down the road, and look at the industry that you are in. Maybe look at recent acquisitions and mergers that have taken place in that industry, and what was their valuation? Was it 10 times their revenue? Was it 5 times their revenue? Was it 20 times their revenue? And if you're projecting that, you know, whatever your revenue or is going to be at that point a couple years down the road, you can 5 times it or 10 times it, whatever the industry standard is, and then say, okay, that I'm going to try to go for that valuation and make the argument to my investors that this ought to be the valuation. The investors will always negotiate you down. They're going to look at your projections and immediately chop off at least 30, if not 50% of what you're saying, and chalk it up to, you know, probably assumption error. But I think the key is to, if you can't get the valuation that you want, or the investors are wanting to take more of the company in exchange for the money that they're putting in, you can then try to negotiate in clawback milestones for you, the entrepreneur, that if you actually hit the projections that you're putting out, then you retroactively get shares back from the investors.
And that is a really great strategy, because that means, okay, yes, you don't have to say no and walk away from a deal. You take the upside that they were doubting in by doing that.
Yep.
So how do you arrive at the amount of money that you want to ask for? Because most of the time I see the clients come in, they are grossly undercapitalized, and they're grossly underestimating how much capital it's going to take to get them from the starting point, the idea, to being in the commercial sector.
I think one of the biggest mistakes young entrepreneurs make, or first-time entrepreneurs make, I guess I should say, is not fully understanding that most likely that first round of capital that you raise is not going to get your company to profitability. And if it is, you have to make sure that you're raising enough capital to do it, and you have to just make the assumption that it's going to take twice as much as you think and twice as long as you think. So raise enough money that you're not going to get down the road and then have to go raise more money, and you haven't taken into consideration who's going to run the business while you're out raising more money, because it becomes a full-time job. So in a business like ours, you try to raise enough money that it gets you to the next milestone. So, for example, you say, okay, look, I need $1 million, and I'm going to hire, you know, these people, and we're going to acquire these customers, and we're going to make these products, and we're going to sell these products. And even if it takes twice as long, this money gets me to a point where I've got sales, I've got customers, there's a shingle out on the door, and it's a real business. And the investors that have put in the first round of capital, of course, they're not going to want to lose the money that they put in. So they are going to understand that you're going to need more money, and they're going to be helping you raise more money. But you can only raise more money at that second stage if you're actually hitting the goals that you set out in the first stage. You have to have a real business that looks like it's growing, or that is growing, for new investors to come in and say, okay, you need the next round of capital. Let's do it. So don't run out of gas before you can get to the next gas station.
Right. And when you're doing something that's innovative, like Music X-Ray is, and new technology, or applying technology to new concepts, what is the challenge in getting that investor to make that connection as to why this is a good idea, why innovate in this market, et cetera?
Well, yeah, the market that you're in, needs to either the market that you're in needs to be experiencing growth so that the overall pie is expanding and there's room for new players to get in, or there's perhaps established players in there that aren't taking care of a niche need that you see, and you feel like you could take care of that better. We're seeing that a lot. Just one industry that comes to mind is in the kind of household products industry, like Procter and Gamble. You know, they're making soaps and detergents for all kinds of markets, and they're the big brands that are in the supermarket. But suddenly, you start seeing small brands coming in with organic soap or hypogenic dog shampoo, where they get really specialized and they start carving away market share that previously belonged to the large companies. But if overall, for some reason, the household product industry were shrinking, then even if you could start to wedge in there and carve off a niche, but the whole industry itself is shrinking, people are buying fewer and fewer of those types of products, that would give an investor pause. You know, do I want to get into a shrinking market? Sometimes, from an investment perspective, it can be really interesting to get into a shrinking market if your business idea is creating efficiencies that are eating up a large share of that shrinking market. That can still be a good investment for them. But yeah, you have to make the argument to the investor about why the overall space that you're in is interesting or exciting.
And does the personality and the investment perspective of a particular angel or VC come into play in how you're going to make the pitch and how you're going to approach what's in that package and how you talk about your numbers and the market and those opportunities?
Absolutely. An investor typically has multiple investments in multiple companies. And they know that some of their investments are going to go better than others. Some of them will go south completely. So a lot of these investors will specialize in an industry or in a market, and they will make investments in companies that they think perhaps eventually down the road there might be synergies between those two companies that they have in their portfolio, where they could merge those two companies, or if one of those companies gets into trouble, the other one could step in and possibly acquire the other company. Those types of investors will typically have relationships with other investors in the same industry where they can invest in each other's companies. When you approach an investor, you want to research them, look at their website, see what other companies they've invested in, understand why your company is complementary or additive to the other companies that they already have in their portfolio. You want to talk to people who are potential investors who understand your industry. You might be an entrepreneur that comes from, like the music industry, for example, which is it's a small cottage industry driven by relationships, and it's really hard to get into because of the value of the relationships. And if I try to go to investors that don't understand that about the music industry, or someone who comes from, you know, the finance world or medical supplies or something like that, they are not going to understand the quirks and the intricacies of the music industry. And one, they won't be able to help me with advice very much. And two, they won't understand the particular needs of my business or why it hasn't taken off as quickly as it could have, et cetera.
So we've kind of mentioned this in passing a couple of times, but the personalities and the perspective of how networked or how expert your investors are, how critical is that to most entrepreneurs to make sure that the investors they do get, as you said, understand your business, but also have the connections to bring in additional investors to help you raise future funds?
It's important. It really depends on your own network as well. There's the expression out there of whether you raise smart money or dumb money, and that's a very simplistic and probably not a very nice way to put it. But smart money in entrepreneur speak is investment from people who understand your industry, who can leverage their networks and their synergies with their own companies to help you get where you're going. Maybe they can help you recruit key advisors, help you get press attention around your company because they have relationships with people in the media that write about that industry. And dumb money is more where it's a purely financial investment. They already know you as an entrepreneur. They know that you have a track record of making other people money. They know that your domain expertise in your industry is fantastic, and they're not really worried about you not being able to find new investors, and they don't really count on you needing them in the future for anything other than perhaps to write another check. So I think first-time entrepreneurs really have to, again, kind of coming back to what we said earlier, focus on what your core strength is. And if it is not raising capital, doing spreadsheets and having a finance network where you can go to get that capital, then you'd be really, you'd do well to find investors who shore up that need for you.
So one of the other challenges I see with the early entrepreneurs and making missteps is they do bring in certain investors, they give them board seats, for instance, and then the board starts driving the timeline based on when they need the return on investment. Or they bring in board members who, let's say they're a spin-out of a university, and they bring in a board member that's a fellow professor that has no industry experience, no commercialization experience, and they don't quite have the right board composition to power the company forward and gain credibility. Have you experienced making those kind of one-off decisions based on where the money comes in from, or were you able to, even from the beginning, kind of step back and say, okay, I'm only going to put on the board the smart money guys?
I don't know that it has ended up being a big mistake for me, but it certainly could have turned out that way. It was more by luck than by planning it. But you know what you find out is that your early stage investors will want to have insight into your company, perhaps have a hand on the wheel, and therefore they'll ask for a board seat. And, you know, where they're representing their shares and they're on a call with you or in a meeting with you once a month, or, you know, maybe once a quarter if they're a little less hands-on. And in my experience, most of the people that I have brought on board at Music X-Ray were not music industry people, but they understood the tech space and they understood the early stage startup space. And they also understood, you know, they knew what they didn't know, or they knew that they didn't know about the music industry and that I came from the music industry. There have been a few times where I'll feel like I have a problem or that I have a decision that I'm not comfortable making on my own. And I'll take that to the board. I'll lay it out for them. I'll give them the information that I have to get their advice on what they would do in this situation. But I have to remember that I have to give them all the information that I have, because if I don't, then they're not taking it into consideration, and they don't know that particularity about the music business that should influence that decision. So I think entrepreneurs should be careful finding the balance between running decisions past your board and trying to get approval for decisions that are, you know, very related to the day-to-day management of your company, versus going to your board and saying, hey, this is the problem that I had. This is the information I used. I made this decision. This is what we ought to do. I'm the CEO. I'm in charge of executing this. I know what we need to do, and I just need I need to bounce it off you or run it past you so that you know and feel comfortable that I know what I'm doing.
So you're asking for advice, not permission.
Yeah. I mean, there are certain things that, you know, you're depending on the statutes of your company or the shareholders agreement, there are certain things that your hands are tied on and you need board approval to do certain things like raise capital or issue shares in a stock option plan or things like that. But to hire a consultant because you need some help recruiting some new customers or some new partnerships, and you know you're going to spend X thousands of dollars a month on that consultant, really you as the entrepreneur are the only one who knows if you really need it, if you really think you can get a return on the investment, if it fits in your budget. And you know, your board will just kind of shrug their shoulders and say, I don't know, you know, we don't, I guess. And I found when I've gone to the board and I've asked permission for those sorts of things, I usually get a no, because I don't it's hard to articulate fully why you need that that consultant or why you're, you know, doing X, Y, and Z. But that really fall under the purview and the responsibility of the CEO. So be a bold leader. Execute your plan, and when you need to change paths, sometimes you're the only one who's going to know it. But you use your board for what you can, and understand what their expertise is. And as your company grows and you bring on new investors, try to make sure that your company doesn't outgrow your board. And you know, when the board only becomes a place you can go to for advice, and there is no one left on the board with deep enough pockets to write another check if you need more capital, or with a network to bring in more capital, then you know you might need to change up the board or restructure the shareholding.
And that raises an interesting point, is that a lot of the people who start as founders of an organization, frequently the organization may outgrow their skill set. How do you, as that founding entrepreneur, that powerhouse, stay objective about, as you said, when do you need a consultant, or when do you need to bring in another executive, when do you need to step back or step into a different role in the company? How do you advise first-time entrepreneurs or even experienced entrepreneurs to sort of set aside the ego and take an objective view of where they are and what they're able to do for the business as it grows?
I think you have to keep in mind that when you bring on investors, even though you might still be the majority shareholder or the largest single shareholder, even if you don't have the full majority, you realize that, okay, this is a partnership now, and we are all in this for the success of the company and for the success of the return on the investment. And you as an entrepreneur are not, probably not, experienced enough to be the CEO of a large company as effective as it would be to bring in someone when you get to that stage who has run companies of that size before and taken them from that stage to the next stage. The entrepreneur, yes, you grow in your business. You always try to stay mentally and prepared one step ahead of where you are. But ultimately, you know, I got into this business, for example, to build a really killer product that made a really big difference in the music business. I'm really good at that. I'm really good at executing a plan and managing a small team. But I didn't get into this business to, you know, navigate a giant ship and deal with the board all the time, and always be looking for new phases of capital, and to do the things that that I would bring in a CEO to do as the company gets larger. It's not so much an ego thing of maintaining control. It's you always want the best people doing each particular job in the company. And when you are not the best person to be doing whatever you're doing, then that's where you that's where you bring in someone else.
You're talking about having a high degree of self-awareness and a level of self-confidence and knowing what you're really good at. When we look at, say, younger entrepreneurs, millennial entrepreneurs, just different people of all ages that are doing this maybe for the first time, perhaps they don't have that level of self-awareness or self-confidence. So can you kind of tip us off into how you arrived at that point of knowing, I'm going to focus on what I'm really good at, be confident in that, and then be confident enough to bring in other people that are really good at the things I'm not good at?
I think a lot of entrepreneurs, are control enthusiasts, I guess we'd say, and are, you know, become insecure that someone else is going to come in here and call the shots, and someone else is going to come in here and be my boss. And, you know, there are plenty of nightmare stories where, you know, people get fired from their own companies when they bring in a new CEO. Steve Jobs is the most famous example of that.
Right.
But if you are really good at what you do, you're going to be very safe in your own company. You know, there's a former competitor of mine, a guy named Tim Westergren, who is the founder of Pandora, the online streaming radio company. And, you know, he got that company to a stage where he stepped back and became the chief strategy officer, which I kind of like that title, because chief strategy officer kind of gives you license to poke your nose into everyone's business, and you still have the title of founder of the company, and you're focused on the product and focused on evangelizing and on what you do best. But you bring in someone else at the stage of the company who's going to do that better. In terms of how you have the self-awareness to do that, I mean, I think that is a a personal maturity sort of thing. You have to realize, you have to know what your limitations are, just like you have to know what your strengths are. Some entrepreneurs, I think, come to the table with a great idea, but not a lot of experience in executing a plan or managing or even building a product, and they may be a little bit insecure that they don't really bring anything to the table except the idea that they had. And I think you have to be really humble in that case and say, look, you know, this is a great idea that I had. I get some equity in the company because I had it. I'm helping get it off the ground. But if I really want this to be successful, I need to surround myself with people who are better at these other things than I am, and you know, I'll learn, and maybe you have a successful exit from this company, and the next time around I will have learned a lot of things, and I'll be able to do a lot more.
So one thing that's been a consistent theme is about the execution and being able to take actions and make things happen. That's not always a skill set, like just in your just most recent comment, that people will frequently be absent, lacking that ability to take action or make things happen. How big of a challenge has that been in dealing with others that maybe within your organization or other organizations that you've been around, to see that contrasting difference between your bent towards action and execution and making things happen along with the idea versus someone that does just have that idea and wants to stay in the passionate idea stage rather than making sure things actually happen.
Yeah, you know, that's tricky, and that's a tough one, I think, for a lot of entrepreneurs to get their heads around, because, you know, they say in business, nothing happens until someone sells something, and the idea is often, you know, an isolated incident. Here's the idea for the product, or here's the design for the product or the service or whatever it is. And then you go through this phase of building the organization and executing the plan and starting to sell that product or that service. And no further creation is needed until you get to that next stage. And if your expertise is the creativity part, there's really not much for you to do until you get to the next stage, where maybe you're going to introduce a new product, or you need to introduce new features or build the product better. And it can be really hard for an entrepreneur who's really only the only value they're bringing to the table is that initial creativity to find their place in the organization along the way. I don't know if that answered the question exactly.
It does. And let's expand a little bit on it, because we're in organizations. We start building what we think the organization is going to be, and then we start looking at what it became, and then we're trying to find our place in it with those skill sets. Is it a matter of organizational design, for want of a better term, or is it consciously trying to work to grow our skills and learn more, even if we're not going to be passionate about it, but while we're being that entrepreneur, that idea person? How important is it that we constantly be in learning mode to acquire new skills, to be able to understand the spreadsheets and the financials, to be able to take our creativity or our ability to generate ideas to spark what's happening in the organization and to grow within our skill sets as we're running these organizations or participating?
There are always going to be times in the company where you're doing things that you don't like to do, or that aren't your core skill set, or that you know, you wish somebody else could do. And sometimes there's just nobody else to do it. And if you don't get good at it, you know, you can go get some advice, or go get one of your advisors or board members to, you know, show you how to build this model or build that spreadsheet. But ultimately, there's no one else to do it unless you go home and spend, you know, 3 hours a night for the next week and a half getting it done. And that is just some of the pain that you have to go through. You have to get good at things that you weren't good at, or at least get competent at things that you weren't competent at. But ultimately, I think if you have started a company, it ought to be in a field that you're passionate about, that you love. The work shouldn't feel like work. If you can turn your passion into your job, say you never work another day in your life. And if I find myself spending more than 20% of my time doing things that I just don't like to do, that make me miserable to do, that I would never go out and find a job doing that, but here I am with my own company, and that's supposed to be great and the dream and your own boss, but you're finding yourself doing stuff you don't like all the time, then that's where you have to pull yourself out, and you have to say, build the organization around yourself that allows you to do the job that you envisioned yourself doing, that you loved doing. And if that's product design, or if that is you know, evangelizing and selling, you know, make in your own company, you do have the opportunity to create your own job and make it what you want, and move everything else off your plate onto other people's plates that, you know, do like doing those other things.
But you're still staying aware in that, and that advice is that you're not saying, okay, I'm never going to look at the financials because I hate financials and it makes me miserable. You're just saying you're not going to build those financials. You're still going to have that level of involvement that you're monitoring and aware and getting all the information you need to still run the organization.
Oh, yes, absolutely. You have to be competent in it. You have to understand it. A lot of times the person that you're going to have build those models for you really needs you there by their side while they are doing it, asking you questions, testing your assumptions, asking you how you reach this conclusion. You can't, as long as you are the principal in the business, whether it's the CEO or the person who raised the capital or whatever, if you're, you know, you've got a responsibility to the people that have invested in your company, you've got a responsibility to the people that you've hired to work in the company, and eventually to your customers, you need to have your finger on the pulse of almost every aspect of the company, even if you're not, you know, neck deep into each portion.
So let me ask you a couple of questions about, I call them the series of three things that every person needs to think about before they make their first pitch is the first one.
Three things that everyone needs to think about before they make their first pitch.
So before you're going to go in and talk to that first investor or make that first sales pitch, what kind of preparation, what kind of focusing in do they, what are the three most important things that they need to be thinking about and able to answer or present to the person they're talking with?
You want to have your presentation as a story. You want to, you don't want to just go in there with charts and numbers and you know, this is the business and this is how I make money. You want to start by saying, look, this is the problem that exists out there in the market, and this is how people are currently solving that problem and the frustrations that they have in solving that problem, and it could be better. And the opportunity for our company is to solve this problem in this way, and we are the right team to do this because we have this experience and that experience, and we know this market, and we have this credibility. And when you tell the story and you can put the investor in the position of the person or the market segment that has that problem and the frustration that it is that problem exists and how it's currently being solved is inadequate, you can get them engaged. You want to make sure that your investors are engaged in the story that you're telling. The next thing you probably want to do is run that presentation by some other people before you go in there, maybe some earlier investors that you have or some other people that you've talked to, and anticipate what questions they're going to have. You don't always want to answer every question that they might have or that can possibly arise in your initial presentation. You know, because they might be minutia questions or not questions that everybody's going to have. But you do want to have the answers, and you might want to have a couple slides prepared at the end of your deck that you can flip to quickly when that question comes up, and you can show it, you know, after your initial presentation.
So what are the three biggest mistakes you think most entrepreneurs make in starting their businesses?
Not biggest mistakes. Maybe not understanding how much capital they're going to raise. I think first-time entrepreneurs psych themselves out with large numbers. You know, when you raise money, it really depends on what kind of business you're starting and in what industry you are in. You know, sometimes $150,000 is a lot of money. Sometimes, if you're not asking for $15 million, you know, an investor is going to look at you and say, why are you coming in here and asking for such a small amount of money with such a Herculean task that you have in front of you? And you can look at the other companies in the space and, you know, the market share that you're going to need to capture in order to be competitive there. There's no way you're going to get it done for this amount of money. But the entrepreneur will tweak their model to a point where it is a shoestring budget, and you have to thread the needle in order to be successful. And almost one of the worst things you can do is actually convince an investor that that's the right thing to do, and then they put in that amount of money, and you know, like we said earlier, you can't get to the next gas station before you run out of gas. So I think the biggest mistake that entrepreneurs make is not raising enough capital or failing to understand how much capital they're going to raise. The next mistake is probably, it's a similar one, but it's manifested differently. You know, having wrong assumptions, assumptions that you've made that are easily debunked by an investor regarding how much it costs to make that product or how much it's going to cost you in distribution, or where you could have done your diligence better to find out what those costs really are. You go in there with some assumptions. An investor can tear them apart very quickly and see that you've made some kind of gross error. And when they find one, then they wonder if all of your other assumptions are that far off as well. And maybe a third mistake that entrepreneurs make is when they co-found a company or bring on partners in their company, they fail to understand that they might be a harder worker or more passionate or more qualified to get the job done. And maybe they've co-founded a company and they're 50-50 with an entrepreneur, but they find out that their skill sets are exactly the same, so they can't complement each other. Or one partner is working much more and bringing much more value to the table than the other partner, and there's a lot of resentment that builds up there. So you have to structure partnerships in a way that maybe vest equity over time. That, you know, we're going to start like this, and if we're still together in 6 months and things are going well, then we each vest this much more equity from Treasury, from the kitty. You know, you can work out those sorts of things with investors as well. They help you structure that stuff.
So that kind of leads us into the next question is, when we're building our team, and the team is really who we're investing in and who our investors are investing in, how do we make sure that we're going through a process that we're getting the right team members and the right chemistry between those team members? And how do we bring them in when we're really strapped for cash in the early stage?
Well, bringing in the right partners is tricky. Well, all the stuff is tricky, right? That's why a program like yours exists. When you don't have cash, the only thing you really have to impart is equity. And then sometimes, you know, the pool of partners that you can choose from is limited, because not everyone can come in and work for equity and not need that steady paycheck. So when you're drawing from a limited pool, I think you have to be especially careful about how married to those partners you become. You know, you can do short-term contracts that automatically renew if both parties are happy, with equity that you're awarding vesting over time, so that you're not giving them, hey, here's X percentage of the company, come in here and do this for me. Then they get in there and it's not working out, you're not getting along personality-wise, or they're not doing the job well enough, and you've given away that percentage of equity, and now you have to get rid of that person, but they leave with that equity. You know, so you want to structure agreements that allow you to kind of wade in the baby pool and work your way up to the deep end.
Yeah, because once you've awarded that equity, and we've seen that in a lot of the startups and early stage companies I've worked with and worked in, is that, say, the CEO decides to immediately award stock to somebody, and 6 months later, that person's not only not delivered on what they were supposed to do, but they've disrupted the entire organization, and they continue to do that because they stay a stock owner even when you remove them from their position in the company.
Yes, that is, you know, that happens. And companies being made up of human beings is, one of the detriments. I guess also one of the strengths, of course. But yeah, personality clashes. And when you're working with somebody and you're taking on a big challenge like building a new company is, it can be like a marriage. You're going to have great times and great celebratory times, but you're also going to have trying times. And you know, having emotional maturity and being able to take a step back and take a deep breath and address the personal problems is a skill in and of itself.
So when you're looking at your team and you're looking where the organization is and say it's hitting the milestones and everything, but you just, you're kind of feeling that something is not quite clicking the way you want to it, or it's not going the direction that you thought you wanted it to go and you want to take a slight detour or take a different path forward, how do you get your organization aligned to deal with that evolution or that change that you want to make?
Well, I think it comes back to being able to tell a compelling story that resonates and that is true. You know, if you have started down a path, you had a reason for doing that, and you were able to sell your investors and your stakeholders and your team on that vision and where we're going and what it's going to look like when we get there and what the path to there is also going to look and feel like. But then the facts change on the ground. Maybe a competitor comes in, or and they get some big investment, or the market changes in some way, and you have to pivot. You have to change the story. When you go back to your investors, stakeholders, and team to tell that story, you have to make sure that story makes sense. It has to make sense to you. Like, okay, look, this is where we were going. This happened. And now it makes it difficult to get where we were going on the same path, but it opens up this new opportunity for us that we're perfectly positioned to seize. And this is how we're going to do it now. And if that's credible and you're honest about it, your team will see that. And you know, they might have feelings about it that aren't positive, but they are able to see where you're coming from and what the problem was and how you're trying to address it. And it actually sometimes ends up being an even bigger opportunity and a better story than the previous one. And keeping everyone aligned and keeping everyone's head in the game is really important. You can't be, you know, especially as your team grows and your stakeholders grow, you can't be off in your bubble thinking on your own and then come to the table and just expect everyone to go where you want to go without you making a compelling case for it.
So what happens in those instances when you have to pivot and then you have to make a substantial change in, say, the executive team, the board, those kind of things? How do you start that transition and how do you deal with all those emotions and uncertainty that can arise in the organization?
I'm not sure, because I don't know that I've ever actually dealt exactly with that issue. I know that there are circumstances where you have built a team, let's say of salespeople that are selling your product, and for some reason you have to shift who you're selling that product to, and the salespeople that you have are specialized in selling to, you know, the retail stores. And now you realize, no, we have to sell to wholesalers. But the sales team I have doesn't really know that market, doesn't have the contacts, isn't experienced in selling to the wholesalers. So you actually have to let some people go and hire some new people and explain that to the rest of the organization. You know, those are really tough things. And I don't know that I don't know that there's a good way and a bad way to handle it from an interpersonal perspective, but those are some really tough challenges that entrepreneurs face. One time I had to fire everybody because we ran out of capital. And then I had to convince some of those people to come back when we got some more capital. Those were really difficult times where they had to believe in me and trust me. I don't know that I would. It was just really tough circumstances to deal with.
I remember my first management class in college, and my professor said, you don't become a manager until you've had to fire somebody for the first time. And because it is, it just kind of takes you into a whole different perspective on what you're doing the first time you do it. And the first time I had to do it, I was 22 running a retail store in Minnesota, and I, like you just said, I had to let everybody go over an employee theft issue. And that really rattles your cage and steps back and say, how do I do this with integrity? How do I do it the right way? And, you know, it really does take your management and your leadership to a whole different level when you're looking at dealing with the hard side of the job.
Yes, yeah. You grow as a person. It doesn't make it easier to fire people. I guess you know, once you've done it, you know what it is, and you know you get through it, and you know that it gets better. But it's always hard when you have to confront someone with a hard truth.
So we have just a couple more minutes. I'm going to just let you talk about any aspect of Music X-Ray and what you've been doing and where it's going that you want to talk about.
Oh, well, thanks. Music X-Ray is a data analytics company that works in the music industry. We help the industry identify high potential songs and talent at the earliest possible stage. And we do that using a combination of crowdsourcing of the music industry decision makers. We use music analysis software, and we use machine learning to analyze and make sense of our data. When musicians come to Music X-Ray, they can submit their music to industry professionals who have opportunities for that music. Some of these industry professionals are the talent hunters at the big record companies. Some of them are what are called music supervisors, who are looking for music to put into various film and television and advertisements that they're working on. There's a big need for music, and there is a giant supply of music. You might be familiar with sites like YouTube or SoundCloud. On SoundCloud, which is kind of like the YouTube for music, there's over 12 hours of audio uploaded every minute. And the music industry just has no way of finding the needles in the haystack. So what Music X-Ray does is it helps musicians stand out, get their music to the industry decision makers. The musicians compete for the top deals on Music X-Ray, but also we've created an environment where the music industry professionals compete for the top songs and talent. So we see about 700 to 900 deals done every month between the music industry and independent musicians. And we have started using our data to predict which songs and which bands are about to land deals in the industry. It's complex with regarding how we do that, but when we do predict that a song or a band is going to be getting an industry deal, we've now begun approaching those artists and those bands and offering to invest in them and help them get those deals and help them get their careers off the ground. So we see the future of Music X-Ray as a bit of an investment fund into the music industry, with our website identifying the lower than average risk music investment opportunities. That's a fancy way of saying showing us early which songs and bands we ought to invest in.
Well, that's great. What's your website?
It's www.musicxray.com.
Well, and I'm going to wrap it up right there, and I want to thank you, Mike, for being on the show, and I hope everyone will check out your technology and your business. And everyone, until next time, stay focused on the important things in life.